Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Dr. Lawyer, idiot chief. For my life is songs of grief with the yellow fear and fearless eyes. It's temper all the times I've tried.
I'm your co-host, Riley Spurl, a future law student interested in all things legal and illegal.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl, and I am just her dad. Well, as you can tell, we still haven't changed the intro music, and we haven't fully, changed over much of anything. You still got Michael at the beginning and Michael at the end, but Michael is always with us in spirit.
Yeah, he's always here.
Yeah, that's right. Whether he's actually here or not, he's with us in spirit.
Yeah.
So, his disclaimer is still good. He did a good job with the disclaimer. He's very lawyerly.
He's not dead, though. That kind of made it sound like he was dead. No. That he's always with us in spirit.
No, like no. In the words of Spamalot, I'm not dead yet.
Yeah, not dead yet.
He is vastly overworked, though.
Yes.
I do still have to call him from time to time to find out how to do certain things that he did for our podcast mm-hmm. that now I'm doing for our podcast. So mm-hmm. he does have to talk me through a few things. So I can confirm, I spoke to him today, he is alive.
Good.
As of today, earlier today, he was still alive and kicking.
Thanks for that weekly Michael check to make sure he's still alive.
It's about like they used to do on a podcast I listened to by some friends of mine from Australia. And they did a check on the prime minister that disappeared there back in like the 60s or 70s or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Harold, I can't remember his name now, but he was a prime minister for Australia. And one day he just went into a rough ocean to take a swim. He was a very outdoorsy kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he never returned.
Wow.
And they never knew what happened to him, never found his body. And there was all kinds of theories about it.
Mm-hmm.
And on their podcast, they would do a sighting about him. Harold Holt, that was his name.
Oh.
And they would do a Harold Holt sighting. But they never found him.
Never found him. No.
He's still out there somewhere.
In spirit.
Yeah. Well, enough about the chit-chat. Suppose we should get to today's topic.
And what would today's topic be, Father?
Well, there was an old movie that I was very familiar with that I hadn't realized at the time when I saw the movie that it was based on an actual true story. And so what the reason that came to my attention is in jail here just last month, the original Amityville killer died in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And so the haunting that's in the movie is mostly about the family that moved in after these killings took place.
Yes.
And so the killings are just seen in flashbacks or whatever. They're not the main point of the story. But that was the main point for these people at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so we thought we would tell the whole story of the Amityville Horror.
Yeah. So who was this original Amityville killer? Because from what I understand, and I'm not a big ghost person, but this couple that told the story that inspired the book and movie after these killings, there's some evidence that maybe they made that story up.
This is true. Now, the story starts out with a Ronald Joseph DeFeo Jr. Running into a bar that was not far from his home and announcing to everyone in the bar that his mother and father had been killed.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, they called the police, and everybody from the bar and him, they rushed back to the house. And the police showed up, and not only were the mother and father dead, but also siblings. Dawn, that was 18, Allison, 13, Mark, 12, and John Matthew, who was 9.
All younger than him.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, he was 23.
Yes. But he claimed, right, that it was because of the house. So before even this book and this movie about those ghosts that were made during this killing, He said it was because the evil forces inside the house.
Well, he said there were evil forces inside his head.
Oh, in his head.
Yes, he heard some evil voices, he thought, and they had told him that his father was planning on killing him.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a preemptive strike. Now, why he felt the need not only to kill the father, but the mother and his brothers and sisters, I'm not sure, because the evil voice didn't mention the whole family, as far as I know. Mm-hmm. It just mentioned the father.
It is interesting.
Yeah, so at first he tried to tell the police that he thought it was some kind of hit, that his dad might have been involved in some mafia stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't take long till the police broke that story down.
Yes. They saw, as they started looking at it, there was no sign of struggle on any of the family members that had died or evidence they had been drugged. None of the neighbors said they heard any gunshots. There wasn't any evidence anyone had broken in. Only the dog, from what I can understand, was all anyone heard, just the dog barking a lot.
Yes, and so as they kept asking him different things of the story, his story was very inconsistent.
Mm-hmm.
And so they started getting the feeling that he had something to do with it. And apparently, he wasn't a very good criminal.
Yeah, he wasn't very good at keeping his story straight or his alibi.
No, and once they started saying they didn't believe him, he kind of fell apart and confessed that he killed his entire family.
Mm-hmm. And he confessed, and of course, when he went to trial, his defense attorney said it was because he heard voices, so entered an insanity plea. Basically saying, you know, he's not responsible. It was the voices in his head.
Yeah, he said, once I started killing, I just couldn't stop. It went so fast. So, you know, it's one of those things, I guess, that once you kill one, I guess you just keep going, huh?
Yeah.
And so then he took a shower and threw away the clothes and everything that was involved, because he was probably a little messy. So he got cleaned up and everything, but...
His stories, though, before he did confess, I thought were interesting, because first he tried to say it was this mafia hitman, and then they said, well, he actually has this pretty good out-of-state alibi. He wasn't even in the state at the time. Then he said, well, it was his sister, Dawn.
Dawn, the 18-year-old.
Yes, killed their dad, and then the mom killed all the siblings, and he only killed his mom, because he saw his mom killing all the siblings. But then... he said he was Dawn shooting all, or he is saw Dawn shooting all of them.
Yeah.
Before he killed Dawn.
So he blamed the mother for having killed the others. Then he blamed Dawn for having killed the others. And somehow in there, he had to kill Dawn, or because she was going to kill him.
Yeah. Or maybe his mom. I don't know. He killed one of them, but only one, because the other one killed everyone else. So that was pretty much the reason the prosecution argued that he had suffered from addiction. He had been abusing drugs, but he knew what he was doing because he came up with all these stories about everyone but him basically being guilty. So obviously he must have known what he was doing was wrong if he didn't just say, well, it was the voices that told me to.
Yeah, they did have a psychiatrist for the prosecution that maintained that although DeFeo was a user of heroin and LSD. He had antisocial personality disorder, but he was aware of his actions. So these drugs mixed with his psychological problems did not mm-hmm. serve him well, but they thought that he knew the difference between right and wrong, which of course, as Michael has told me before, constitutes mens rea.
Yes, that is the mental capacity to be guilty of something, basically, right?
To understand the gravity of what you've done.
Right.
Now, he later came up with another story
mm-hmm.
that he was actually married to someone else. He was married to a Geraldine Gates and was living in upstate New York, but that there was a guy associated with her named Richard Raimondo, and he might have had something to do with it because he didn't like that he had married this lady.
Mm-hmm.
So he tried to sell that story too. And they investigated it, and they finally came up with the conclusion Richard Raimondo didn't exist.
Right.
And he also, this lady, I don't know why she helped him out. They never explained that. But they actually married after the incident, after the murder, I guess a murder is more than an incident. Mm-hmm. Huh? So after the murder took place, so he actually married her after the murder to try to create this cover story.
Mm-hmm. I did think it was interesting that he, after he was convicted, so in 1990, several years later, he filed a motion, a 440 motion, a very specific kind, but basically requesting to have his conviction vacated because he said his sister and this unknown assailant who fled the house before he could get a good look at him killed their parents, and Don then killed all their siblings. The only person he killed was Don. Again, he went back to this story talking about marrying Geraldine, and her brother was with him at the time of the murders. An affidavit from this Richard Raimondo was submitted to the court, but he was never located to testify in person. So that obviously did not end up in vacating his conviction, but he tried to bring that story back in there yet again.
Well, and then he sat down with a guy named Rick Osuna, who wrote the first book about it. Mm-hmm. And so he gave him some details, but when the book came out and basically said he was guilty, then he disputed that he had ever even talked to him and that Osuna made the whole thing up.
Mm-hmm. He said he didn't give him anything abused in the book. He just left the interview.
Yeah. But strangely, though, what he wrote was very similar to what the police had concluded had happened, mm-hmm. and his original confession.
Right. Yeah. And then, of course, the ghost come in, the real plot of our movie that we've all seen, when the next couple moved in, only for 28 days, from what I understand. And they, you know, said they had all these instances of ghosts and voices, but actually it was DeFeo's attorney in that case, who was William Weber, who talked directly to George and Kathy Lutz, this couple. He says they came up to him within that 28 days and said, "Hey, we created this horror story over many bottles of wine. It's a total hoax."
Right. But George and Kathy Lutz, they moved into the house about 13 months after the murders had taken place. Now, I assumed that if you moved into a place like that, you probably would have not known about the murders.
Mm-hmm.
But they did know. They were informed by the real estate agent that the murders had taken place, but they were getting a real good deal on the house.
So, I'm sure if, you know, you have sextuple homicide, yeah, in a house,
yeah,
get a pretty good deal.
Yeah, so this house was greatly underpriced there. And so they bought the house anyway and moved in. And one of the house's most distinctive features were these rounded arches at the top or around the windows, so that at night, when those windows were lit up, it kind of looked like two eyes looking out. And in most all your movie covers, all the, you know, promos for it and everything, it's this house is what they show. And the house, especially if you put red lights in the windows, it makes it look very evil and eyes looking out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this house, where it actually happened, was at 112 Ocean Avenue in Long Island, New York, on the south shore of Long Island, New York. And because that this had happened, there was a lot of looky-loos that kept coming by and going there and everything. So they would not give anybody the rights to come there and film, mm-hmm. when they started making this movie. So they ended up having to build a sort of a replica of it in, I believe it was Connecticut.
That makes sense when you think about it, because one, I wouldn't want to be in that house to film that movie if I'm an actor in that movie. But two, I mean, I don't know. Would you want to use the real house? Does that not feel a little like directly exploitative? At least if you build like a reconstruction, then you're not talking exactly about the people it's about, because I don't know about you, but I never knew this was about a real thing. you know, I know it says it's based on a true story, but lots of movie or horror movies say that, but just to make it scary.
Well, I didn't know about it beyond the George and Kathy Lutz part when they moved in and they were haunted. That was a part I knew that was supposedly the real story. And the part about the murder before that, I thought that was a made up part of the movie.
Right.
When I saw the original movie that had James Brolin and Margot Kidder as George and Kathy Lutz. And, you know, because that was where it started. And it wasn't until, you know, that towards the end that they kind of suggest that Ronald DeFeo's spirit had started inhabiting them and making the husband, James Brolin, start thinking about murdering his family. And I thought that was a made up part, that the haunting had taken place and they were just kind of theorizing something like that made it up. I didn't realize that the actual six people murdered thing was the real story.
Yeah. Yeah, I had no idea. Especially if they're going to make such a reconstruction of the house and the people that lived there, then to not mention that specifically in the movie, would there have been any reason, maybe privacy reasons, that they couldn't have mentioned certain things?
I wouldn't think so.
I mean, I wouldn't have imagined so, especially since it was based on their story, the Lutzes, and, you know, they had written this book that became the movie, and also because all that information about the murders was public knowledge.
They used their real name in the movie. So I think that they were trying to get, you know, there's a theory about it that they moved in there and kind of planned this whole thing.
Yes.
So that they could sell the story.
Yes. And this was what actually made DeFeo's attorney, that Weber I mentioned, who said George and Kathy Lutz came to him and said, you know, we have this idea for a book that we made up about this house. He actually brought a lawsuit against them for taking the story they had shared with him to another publishing partner. And he said, I want to share the profits. You know, you brought this to me first. We talked about it. I guess maybe he thought he'd help them flesh it out, create it in some way. He also was not their attorney, but an attorney offering them legal advice. So he said, I want a share of the profits that were $60 million. But eventually they settled out of court. And he only got $2,500 plus $15,000 for his services connected with the book and the movie.
Well, he could never actually prove that he had anything to do with it, but he did say that he did, helped him concoct it. Now, there was a dual mission in him doing that, though, because by concocting this haunting, he was also laying the groundwork to try and get Ronald DeFeo released still again.
Right.
He was trying to bring this haunting into it. Now, while Ronald DeFeo had said that he had heard voices, he never really said there was an evil house that had done this to him.
Right.
You know, and so the Lutzes only stayed in that house for like, what, 28 days or something like that?
28 days is what I saw, just about a month.
And when you think about it, they said that they were threatened by evil presence. Now, the Lutzes would never do an open interview. They kind of had a prepared statement of what would be read to the press of what happened.
Right.
But they wouldn't take questions, and they wouldn't go into any detail. And only, I mean, like, here's the only things that they talked about was that there was a priest that came in to do a blessing of the house. And when the priest showed up, the Lutzes happened to be gone. So the priest went into the house and went to perform this blessing. And when he did, a voice said, "Get out."
Ooh.
And he kind of looked around like, did I hear something? And then he started the blessing and it was louder the next time. Get out! And so he got out.
Yeah, I would too.
But they never did identify who this priest supposedly was. And they checked with the ones in the area and, you know, the ones that they thought it was. And they said, look, I never went to that house. I went there one time that I was invited there and I went there. Nobody was home and I went back home. I never went in. I don't know anything about it. They talked about flies on the window. An ungodly amount of flies that were there, but nobody ever saw those.
Right.
There was never an exterminator called or anything. And they talked about green slime coming from windows and cracks in the walls and things like that that represented blood.
That's just from Ghostbusters.
Is that what that
is? That's what Slimer does.
Who whenever you gonna call?
Yeah, whenever he's sliming around, he just leaves green slime everywhere. That's where they got that from.
But there was nobody that ever saw that. Then after that, they just said they felt an evil presence and they were threatened by this evil presence.
Yes. And their sons also said they did. One of their sons, Daniel, said he was possessed, like in The Exorcist. That's what he compared it to, like the little girl in The Exorcist. And their other son said he did have run-ins with the paranormal, including the time he saw a presence as definite as a shadow in the shape of a man that moved towards him and then dissipated.
Yeah, now this was like 30 years after the fact.
Yes, this was much, much later.
Yeah, as kids, they didn't say anything about it. They didn't have much to say. But about 30 years later, two of the sons, the younger ones, they did stand up and say, we remember there was evil presence and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure what to make of that other than kids are very impressionable.
Mm-hmm.
And if they heard their parents talking about it and all these other, you know, kids have a very active imagination. They might remember a dream as real life or something like that. Or they might just hear about it enough where they imagine, you know, I do remember this happening or that happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they everybody wants to be a part of it.
Yeah.
So
it is interesting to me to think about, though, you know, their DeFeo's defense attorney helped them with this, which, like you mentioned, was maybe to help him in proving his client wasn't guilty, that, you know, there was this evil spirit or whatever in the house. But is a haunted house a good legal defense? Is that something that would hold up too well in court?
Well, things like that have been tried.
Sure.
I don't know how many have been successful,
right.
But they have been tried.
Okay.
You know, where you were possessed by an evil spirit and that's why you did it. I remember one story about a guy who killed his mother-in-law with an axe.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in the garage and he said it was dark and his mother-in-law came walking in and he thought she was a raccoon. So he took an axe and hit her. And about after the third whack, he realized it was his mother-in-law, but something just snapped and he couldn't stop. Kind of like what Ronald DeFeo said, that once he started shooting, he couldn't stop.
That's a big raccoon, though.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't know if she was wearing a fur coat or something.
Still, I mean, even if she's a small person, she's still a person.
Yeah, well, I wonder if she was making raccoon noises or something. You know, they have those
crawling on the ground.
And they're wearing a bandit mask.
That's true.
I wonder if she had like a bandit mask or something.
I guess it's possible.
But I don't think that was really the reason he did it.
Yes, I think you're probably right.
He may have snapped or something. I'm not sure.
Well, it seems like to me if you were going to use a defense like that, that it was something that made you so you couldn't stop, or you were in a haunted house and you had just been driven mad by these spirits that were possessing you. That seems to me like it would be more so like, okay, well, this is like an insanity defense. You know, like they have some sort of mental illness that made it so they aren't aware of reality or don't have mens rea, don't have the capacity to understand what they're doing is wrong. Unless like, well, you're right, ghosts are real. It's on them, not on you. You can go.
But that was 1975 when the Lutzes moved out of the house.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, under these terrifying situations. And then the original Amityville Horror was released in 1979.
Wow.
When it came out. Now, here's the thing that I found interesting. I have seen several of them, Amityville Horror 2, and, you know, and number 2 was just, you know, another take on it or whatever,
sure.
But they actually went into the possession part of it. I think it went more into the triple, or the sextuple murder, or whatever you call that. But there have actually been 21 films made of the Amityville Horror.
21?
Yeah, I mean, and some kind of go off on a tangent, and there's several different things that they add in.
Sure.
And here's the thing that amazed me. On several of them, they were released in the same year. Like in 2016, you had 4 different versions of the Amityville Horror. You had Amityville No Escape, Amityville Vanishing Point, the Amityville Legacy, and the Amityville Terror. 2015, there was a couple that year. 2017, there was 2. Amityville Prison and Amityville The Awakening. Now, one of those had, I'm not sure which one it was, but it had Ryan Reynolds in it. And he played he played the dad, and they had a scene where he chopped the family dog up with an axe. He was supposed to be like George Lutz. Mm-hmm. And he chopped the family dog up with an axe, and he was, I don't know, pulled a knife or a gun on his wife or something like that. And they said the Lutzes actually sued them because everybody knew who they were, mm-hmm. and nothing like that ever happened, you know? And so they were saying, this defamed us that you portrayed me. I never killed the family dog,
yeah.
and I never threatened any of my family members with a gun or anything. But that's, you know, that's kind of what they insinuated with the one with James Brolin too, mm-hmm. is that he was feeling these urges to kill his family because of that.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's a lot of movies. That seems like some of those must have been more popular than others.
And the latest one came out in 2020, The Amityville Harvest.
I didn't even hear about that one.
Yeah. Now some of these were not released in movie theaters.
Sure, like direct-to-TV or DVD they were, movies.
Right, mm-hmm. made-for-TV movies, direct-to-video, whatever.
Direct-to-DVD? You know. What am I saying? It's 2021. They probably went to a streaming service, not DVD.
Well, yeah, they could. That might be right.
Makes me sound old.
And somewhere along the way, that this is a tried and true trope. You will hear this in a lot of horror movies when they go back to the original haunting. Do you have a guess as to what they blame the original haunting on?
No.
In the land where they do it?
No.
The land where the house was built? It was an ancient...
Oh, a burial ground?
Burial mm-hmm. ground. Mm-hmm. And yeah, they associated it to the Shinnecock tribe mm-hmm. that was located in the Long Island area.
Okay.
And they tried to say that it was an ancient burial ground of the Shinnecock tribe and that this is what the original was. Well, they've had anthropologists and they've had people that are, you know, from the Shinnecock tribe. And they came and they said, look, we didn't bury anybody here. Mm-hmm. This is not a burial ground.
Right.
Don't get us involved.
Yeah. We only had want nothing, a part of this.
No, we had nothing to do with this. Man. Well, don't get us involved in this tripe.
Yeah. This very much reminds me of like the Conjuring movies and those stories behind those. But those are all about ghosts. Those are just, you know, ghosts live in this house and all the crazy things that happen. But it also has to do with parents threatening their kids and becoming almost murderers. This did make me think of Criminal Minds, though, in a way, as we were talking about this, because there's a kind of Criminal Minds is a TV show, and they profile, mm-hmm. it's fictional, but they profile mm-hmm. killers or criminals, and they talk a lot about family annihilators, people that kill their whole family, mm-hmm. Which actually is, in reality, a very specific type of murderer. And usually it's a father, and if it's not a father, then it's almost always a man, so that applies here. And they've kind of categorized them into four different kinds, so they say almost all of them fall into these categories based on studies they've done and research. Self-righteous ones, disappointed mm-hmm. killers, anomic killers, and paranoid killers. All have their different reasons, but it seems to me out of all these options, the first one, self-righteous killers, this says they, you know, hold someone else responsible, like a mother, a sister, for the breakdown of the family. And basically that is their responsibility. It's not really on them. It's whoever was responsible for what happened before. That seems to me like it's very likely in this case after, you know, he blamed it on his sister and also his mother at some point.
That's true. What about the other three varieties? What are those? What's behind those?
Yeah, disappointed ones, which is very, I don't know, kind of ironic to me to call it disappointed killer.
I'm going to kill somebody.
Yeah, they think their family has let them down. So something like sparked by children not choosing to follow religious customs or something like that, follow family traditions. Anomic killers see the family as a symbol of their own economic success, but if they suffer some kind of economic failure, like bankruptcy, then the family no longer serves its function. This is mostly related to like fathers or patriarchal figures in a household. And then finally, paranoid killers are ones that think they are protecting their family from some sort of threat. Either something that they have some sort of mental illness that they have imagined a threat, or something like they worry their kids are going to be taken away by social services.
I'm worried someone's going to kill you, so I'll kill you so they can't kill you.
I'm going to protect you, make it so they can't kill you, because I'll kill you first.
But in a way, his was kind of paranoid kill too, because he believed that the father was plotting to kill him and that the family was helping him or something like that, so...
So in kind of a reverse way, it wasn't really a desire to protect his family. It was a desire to protect him.
Himself.
Sure.
Yeah. Oh, I thought you would be interested, too, in the Amityville, The Awakening. That starred Jennifer Jason Leigh and Bella Thorne.
Mm.
So there's a recent one there. That's a Disney
girl, right? She was a Disney girl. Disney
right?
girl. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I also did see that the Lutzes, the two parents, at some point much later, took a lie detector test, actually, about their story.
Mm-hmm.
And both of them passed.
Yep.
Which they from what I have read, people think, well, they told a story for so long, even if it's not real, this is what they wrote, this is what made them famous, this is what the movie is, and they've been telling to, you know, statements to give to the press or the public. Maybe they just, I don't know, it's become their truth.
Well, now, here was another group that kind of crusaded against them, too. As you said, they got it. The Lutzes got a deal on this house. They bought it for $80,000. Well, the next group that came along got an even better deal, because now not only had there been six murders, but there was also a haunted house, supposedly.
Now there are ghosts.
So the Cromarties came along, and they bought the house for $55,000. So it just keeps going down.
Mm-hmm.
But they also, they did a complete renovation of it. They took out those classic windows that looked like eyes. Mm-hmm. They remodeled that whole thing so it didn't look a thing like the old one. And they went as so far as to get the address changed.
Wow.
So when people tried to come to the 112, whatever it was, Ocean Avenue, mm-hmm. Ocean Boulevard, whatever it was, when they tried to come to it, you couldn't find it. They're driving around saying, well, it should be right here, but this is 123 or something like that.
Oh, that's funny.
So they changed it because they couldn't stand all the people coming. And the city didn't sure. want people coming in there either because
yeah.
they were destroying their tranquility, all these looky-loos coming and walking around. I mean, people would come up and knock on the door. Can we come walking through your house and look?
Oh, I wouldn't like that.
See if we see anything? But they lived there, and they had absolutely no problems.
Mm-hmm.
Never had any hauntings, never had any ooze coming from the walls, no Slimer.
No get outs,
mm-hmm. no flies, no nothing. Nothing ever happened. So they kept making that public. They were wanting the Lutzes to agree that it was all made up.
Mm-hmm.
And and they also wanted to be able to, that their property values would go up
mm-hmm.
if the Lutzes agreed
admitted
that
this was a hoax.
Yeah, this was all a hoax.
Yeah.
Yes, they couldn't take away the murder. But the haunting was a hoax.
Mm-hmm.
So they campaigned for a long time for them to admit that they actually made it all up. But let's see, if I remember right, Kathy died first. She died in like 2001 or 2002.
Mm-hmm.
And then George died in 2008, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm.
And he did finally say at the end, he never said that it was made up, but he did say whether it was made up or not, it was a pretty good story, wasn't it? So,
well,
he did kind of back off on the hard stance that it was real. They never gave that lawyer any credit for it. And the lawyer says he did most of the work on that.
Right.
You know, most of the incidents that mm-hmm. they threw together.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you think about it, as hauntings go, that wasn't really a bad haunting. I mean,
no, not too bad. No one got hurt.
I mean, yeah. And then supposedly a priest heard a get out, but you can't find the priest.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody ever saw the ooze or the flies. Now, somebody did theorize there was something happened with the house, like there was some stuff that had been left in it that mm-hmm. had rotted, and all these flies had gathered in the house, but that was because of food like that had been left behind in the house.
Well, that makes sense.
And so it caused that. So that was like that was the idea of where the flies came from
mm-hmm.
for it. And then just a generic, I felt an evil presence.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed threatening. You know?
That's not too bad.
No. But I thought it was funny that they said they fled the house with only three changes of clothes each. Why three?
Well,
and
that's
why
very
all
specific.
Of them? Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know. I guess if I were, and they only lived there for 28 days, if it was me and the only things I had experienced in 28 days were those things, and I had just gotten this house and just spent this money on this house, I don't know if I would have been that quick to move out.
Yeah, no. Call in the exterminator. And,
yeah, I would have held out just a little bit longer.
Yeah, I think so.
Called the Ghostbusters.
I mean, there's no evidence that George actually started thinking about murdering his family, you know, mm-hmm. like the wife wakes up and sees him hovering over her with a gun or a knife or something like right. that, you know.
Yeah. So. But the movie did become the highest grossing independent film of all time up until 1990, so.
That's hard to believe, isn't yeah. it? And it was based off of a wine-drinking lawyer with a family looking to make a buck.
Yeah.
And George and Kathy did divorce later on.
Mm-hmm.
They got divorced. They were, although they remained amicable, and they never turned on each other as far as saying that he thought of it or he wanted to do it or he made me do it or anything like that.
Well, they probably were making enough money off of all their various movies and rights and books and appearances that they figured, well, might as well just keep with it.
And there were a lot of lawsuits involved, too.
Yeah.
There were people that sued them, and they sued a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Ryan Reynolds killing the dog just pushed the guy over the edge.
Yeah.
I never killed a dog, damn it. Don't get me involved in that. The ASPCA will come after me.
But of course, it was most recently that DeFeo died.
Yes, he died in prison. They didn't say why. I was really curious whether it might have been COVID.
Well, that was what also I wondered, because he was, what, 69, so he was older. He was in prison, which, you know, has commonly recently been a cause for spread pretty quickly.
Right. He'd been in there for a while because he was
for a long time.
23 when he committed the murders, probably 24 by the time he went to jail.
Yeah. So
he was in there
45 years, something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
But it says it's still pending an autopsy. It's ruling on death or but cause
they,
of death.
They gave him, it was second degree murder is what they called it. They didn't call it premeditated. They charged him with 6 counts of second-degree murder and gave him 25-year sentence for each one.
Yes.
And they weren't concurrent. They were consecutive.
Right. So pretty much a life sentence.
Right. Yeah. That's, what, 150?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think anyone... you mean, you're already 23, 24, so... I don't know if anyone's lived to 175 yet.
Not yet. I'm working on it.
Yeah. One day.
I'm almost halfway there.
Well... Not quite.
So that's our breakdown on the Amityville Horror. And like I say, it was triggered by the original murderer dying in prison last month. And like I say, I was surprised to know, first, that there was an original murderer. Yeah. And second, that he just died. That yeah. he wasn't already dead. Seems like that was a long time ago. I mean, I watched that movie, you know, I wasn't a kid, but I was a young adult.
Mm-hmm. That was still, I mean, a few decades before I was even around.
Yeah, I mean, so. James Brolin was a big studly guy in that, and now he's a grandpa on Life in Pieces.
Is that how you feel?
Which is now off the air.
Yeah.
Yeah. All my contemporaries are grandpas and better.
Uh-huh. I do think it's funny, the tagline for the movie was, "For God's sake, get out."
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, it was just pretty funny to me, like, making such a big deal about, get out of this house. And it's like, well, they kind of took their time getting out of this house. They brought 3 changes of clothes each.
Yeah. All right, now, kids, grab yourself 3 changes of clothes.
I mean, maybe that's just all they could fit in their suitcases. Maybe it wasn't, like, a rush thing, and maybe it was just, like, a space thing.
But they all had the same size suitcase?
Maybe. I mean, they probably went back at some point and got the rest of their stuff, right?
Well, probably
someone else moved in later.
Yeah,
had to have gotten it at some point.
I think they had movers go get it. I think they hired people to go clean out the rest of their stuff. They didn't leave it behind. I mean, they did for 3 days.
Yeah.
Then they sacrificed some movers.
Yeah.
They hired them to go in, and they waited around the corner peeking. Let's see if they come back out. Let's see if they're still alive. If, you know, the truck's parked there a week later.
Uh-huh.
And they're still there and the people are gone. Well, I got to hire some more movers.
Did it again. That house. Well, now it's time for
legal briefs.
Okay. So I had talked about from my love for Criminal Minds, the profile of the family annihilator.
Mm-hmm.
And there are 4 different kinds or categories they tend to put them in. Do you remember what the 4 were?
One was disappointed.
Mm-hmm.
One was paranoid.
Mm-hmm.
One was, did you say economic?
Anomic.
Anomic, which had to do with the economic mm-hmm. abilities, the economies of the family or whatever. And the other was Annihilator?
Or, well, no. That's what all of them are.
Oh, but it was the one where you you think that you're protecting them or something like that.
Well, that was Paranoid.
Oh, that was Paranoid? Whoa.
This one's the one where they would often like hold someone else responsible and for the breakdown of the family.
Well, I forget what that one was.
Self-righteous.
Self-righteous.
You got the other three. You got three out of four.
And, you know, what made I thought of this when you talked about it earlier, then I forgot. You were talking about Criminal Minds.
Mm-hmm.
There was actually a CSI New York that did, it. They didn't call it Amityville.
Right.
But it was investigating a haunted house that looked a lot like this. And they did that like back in 2005 or something like that.
Interesting.
And so they investigated the haunting.
Did they find ghosts?
No.
No.
No, they didn't.
Yeah, probably just a murderer.
Yeah.
My last legal briefs question for you. I said this one reminded me of The Conjuring in those movies. Very similar. Haunted house. People died. They wrote books about it. They became movies. Do you know what the name of the doll is that's in all the Conjuring movies? That's the big haunted doll that everyone's scared of getting out of its box.
Annabelle.
Yes. That's it.
Hey, like that, I pulled that one out.
I can't believe that.
I started to say Anastasia, and then Annabelle came to me at the last minute.
That's it.
Well, I have one for you.
Okay.
If a person does a bunch of bad things and they get a bunch of different sentences, the judge has the ability to give them to you to serve in two different manners. Do you remember what those two different manners are?
Like in terms of in what order? Like concurrent or consecutive?
Correct.
Yes.
That was what we were looking for.
Okay. Ding, 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 ding. Yay. I knew that one. Because concurrent would mean like if you got six sentences of 25 years, he would only serve 25 years because they're all the same time.
Serve them all at the same time,
but consecutive would be 150 years.
You finish the first 25, now you start on the next 25. And so on and so forth until you die in prison.
Yeah.
As happened.
Yeah.
So, you know, in most cases, I never understand when they give them to them consecutively. I mean, concurrently.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, if they did all these horrible things, then why would you want to give them the chance to get out?
Right.
Get out. It was somebody
just like the ghost
in prison.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're in prison. That's how you get parole. You're just sitting there in prison. All of a sudden you hear a voice that says, get out.
I didn't realize that's how that worked.
Yeah.
That's interesting. The more you know.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Dr. Lawyer Indian Chief.
We're proud to be coming to you almost live from Smurl Studios, high atop Three Last Mountain.
And we want to thank Audio Boom for being a part of their network.
And we also want to thank the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for helping give us our start. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, Still Buffering, and many other fine offerings.
If you have the chance, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. And if you didn't, don't bother.
You're not supposed to say that.
You're going to edit that out though, aren't you?
Why? You never did.
Thanks for listening. This has been Court Appointed. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude. Hello, and welcome to Tommy's Random Thought. Today's random thought is mask wearing. I recently went to New York to visit Taylor and do some episodes together of our other podcast, Neat the Boozecast. Since I have my new knees and have been trying to get back into shape, I told Taylor, don't spare me. If you would normally walk to where we were going, then I want to walk. Believe me, I was not spared. We walked everywhere. One thing that really stood out to me, though, was the overwhelming number of people wearing masks. Now, don't get me wrong. I know we are supposed to be wearing them, but it has been my observation at home in West Virginia that we're lucky to get 50% compliance. But in New York, with all of that mass of humanity and so many different ethnicities and languages and the whole diversity thing going on, I saw about 98 to 99% mask compliance. I was really surprised. Having gotten the vaccine, I don't really feel like I need to wear the mask anymore. However, if we are all being team players, then we need to continue wearing them regardless. And they were. If someone walked into a place without one, usually someone behind the counter would quickly say, "Hey, you got a mask? Well, then put it on." If the answer was no, then they all seemed to have a supply ready, and they would respond, "Then put this on," and throw it at them. Not one person that I observed answered back negatively. They just put it on and went about their business. No one got in fights or had screaming matches or shot each other. They may not have liked it, but they did it. I know that mask wearing is getting old and we are all ready to be done with it. The time is getting closer every day where that may happen, but we are not there yet. Don't be a part of the problem. Now, when we are so close to eliminating this thing, don't give it somewhere else to go and mutate and actually prolong this inconvenience. Let's ride it out a little longer and we will have this thing beat. If they can comply to that degree in New York, with all of those millions of people living on top of each other, surely we can do it in places like West Virginia and others where life is not quite so intense. I had a great visit with Taylor, and I earned a great respect for New Yorkers and their commitment to each other. Let's all try to do the same for each other, for just a little bit longer. This has been Tommy's Random Thought.